by Israeli troops and buried by a bulldozer near Gaza City. And Jordanians gather outside the Israeli embassy in the capital Amman for the third consecutive night, calling on their government to cancel all treaties with Israel. Hello and welcome, everybody. We start the bulletin with Gaza, where the Israeli regime keeps pressing on with its genocidal campaign for nearly 6 months. Over the past 24 hours, 62 more Palestinians are killed in airstrikes on the besieged strip. Fresh Israeli bombardments targeted several areas, including the central city of Deir al-Balah and Gaza City. Warplanes once again hit the vicinity of Al-Shifa Hospital, which was besieged by occupation forces about 2 weeks ago. According to the Euromed Human Rights Monitor, the regime's troopers have shot and killed some 13 children in and around the hospital in 1 week. The group says many Palestinians were also killed while trying to flee the medical complex. Meanwhile, the southern city of Rafah, which is hosting 1.5 million people, remains under the threat of a ground invasion. Israeli onslaught on Gaza continues despite worsening humanitarian situation there. Since the onset of the war, more than 32,550 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza, mostly women and children. Our correspondent, Moti Abu Musab, joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah to update us on the situation in the war-ravaged strip.
Multiple neighborhoods were targeted and hit relentlessly by the constant and continuous Israeli airstrikes that targeted Al-Shija'iyya, Al-Zaytun, and Al-Nasr neighborhoods. The fresh attack in those areas actually was carried out in Al-Shija'iyya neighborhood after the Israeli warplanes targeted and destroyed a residential building in that area, claiming the lives of at least 3 Palestinian civilians, in addition to dozens of the Palestinian injuries from the women and the children. According to multiple eyewitnesses, that the entire square and the entire vicinity of the Shifa Medical Complex reduced to be mounds of debris over the constant and the concentrated attacks that reached the buildings in that area. In Jabalia refugee camp as well, the Israeli warplanes continue their strikes against the central buildings. The most relentless airstrike targeted a store of the electrical devices in Jabalia refugee camp. A big blaze erupted and ignited in that area. In the eastern part of Al-Burej refugee camp, the fierce clashes erupted between the Palestinian resistance and the Israeli occupation forces. It's worth mentioning that Al-Burej refugee camp also was subjected to a brutal ground offensive after the Israeli occupation forces attacked that area a couple of months ago. While when it comes to Khan Yunis city, particularly the western parts of the city, the Israeli warplanes also continued their airstrikes against the surrounding areas of the Nasser Medical Complex and Al-Amal town. As a result of that continuous and constant Israeli airstrikes and attacks, a Palestinian civilian was reportedly killed.
On this segment of the program, the Israeli regime is facing condemnations after new footage emerged showing its forces fatally shooting unarmed Palestinian men on the Gaza beach and burying them by bulldozer. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has denounced Israel and called on the UN and international courts to hold the regime accountable for the crimes being committed in Gaza. It said the footage is, quote, further evidence of the scale of fascism and criminality that governs Zionist behaviors. America's largest Muslim civil liberties and advocacy organization has also deplored the killings. The Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, has demanded an international investigation into what it called the heinous war crime. The footage captured by long-distance camera shows the men walking along the beach waving a white cloth and a sign of surrender before Israeli troops shoot them dead. The regime soldiers then bury the victims with a bulldozer. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have political analyst Ali Rizk, who's joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also, we have podcaster and journalist Esha Krishnaswamy joining us from St. Petersburg. Welcome to the program. To the both of you, let's start off with Mr. Rizk. I want to get your perspective on this recent video, which is just depicting one of many war crimes and crimes against humanity the Israelis have committed during this genocide. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says that this video is further evidence of the scale of fascism and criminality that governs the Zionist behaviors. Break that down for us, please.
Well, I think that the Israeli approach from the outset was very clear, the dehumanization of the Palestinians. If you recall, at the beginning of the Israeli military operations, the Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, referred to the inhabitants of Gaza as being quote-unquote human animals. And I think that the Israeli behavior and the Israeli military operations that have taken place in Gaza do reflect that particular mindset, the dehumanization of the Palestinians. And I think that this dehumanization element has been especially felt with this current government, which is described as the most right-wing in Israel's history. You have figures like Smotrich, and you have Ben Gafir and others who have taken the animosity or the hostility to the Palestinians towards a new level or to a new level. This, as I say, is being reflected by the Israeli military action on the ground. But in the end, this all backfires against Israel. When people see these images, I think that that just only harms Israel further. Even the former American president, Donald Trump, mentioned in a recent interview that Israel was losing the public relations war, if you would like. So it has a lot of negative repercussions for Israel.
Ms. Krishnaswamy, do you agree with our guest, Mr. Rizk, about the damaging effect that all of this is having on the Israeli regime? And also, if you may, the impunity that the Israelis have been enjoying, it's basically pushing even the Israelis' limits as to how grotesque their crimes can be.
Yeah, it is damaging Israeli perception on Israel around the world, but unfortunately, it might not have an effect on ending the impunity just because of the way the UN Security Council is designed. And we all know there is one country that will always veto any resolutions against Israel, the USA. And on Monday, for example, the U.S. abstained on a resolution for ceasefire, while they also, the State Department spokesperson John Kirby, also reiterated that their policy of sending weapons will not change. And there's also evidence that the U.S. wants to have a demilitarized Gaza, i.e. one without any resistance. So combined with this, it's hard to see how their impunity will end if they keep getting unlimited supply of weapons and support from the U.S.
Ms. Rizk, let's talk about the issue of accountability, which, as we know, just recently, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called for the U.N. and international courts to hold the regime accountable for the killing of the unarmed Palestinians that we just saw. The ICJ made a preliminary ruling, and the Israeli Prime Minister basically laughed that off. We saw the recent United Nations Security Council resolution that was passed, which called for an immediate ceasefire during the holy month of Ramadan. That has not been implemented as well. So the question is, where and when will we see this issue of accountability, the issue of consequences for the crimes that the Israelis have continued to commit for over seven decades? Where and when will that take shape?
I think that the only kind of accountability we could imagine in this day of age is the accountability which is represented by the resistance on the ground. The costs inflicted on Israel by groups like Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen. So I think the accountability for the time being, at least, only will come in that form in terms of the costs Israel is forced to pay. You know, people, soldiers being killed or wounded, its home front being under attack. But in terms of the wider international accountability, which I think you're referring to, I think that as long as the U.S. is in charge or is the leading player of world affairs, that is going to be a very difficult thing to achieve. We all know the U.S. Outright support for Israel, which stems primarily, or a major factor behind it, is the domestic political calculations, the sway or the weight which groups like AIPAC enjoy. So given that background, or given these factors, I think that you're not going to see that wider international accountability as long as the U.S. remains the major force and has the major say in world affairs.
Ms. Krishnaswamy, same question to you as well. Our guest in Beirut, Mr. Risk, believes that as long as the United States is a major player and it gives its unconditional support to the Israelis, this lack of accountability for the Israeli regime will persist. How can the status quo change? And also, do you think that maybe regional blocs, Arab countries, Islamic countries, they should take matters into their own hands and continue to put more pressure and pile more pressure on the Israeli regime?
I also agree with our other guest. Accountability may be only gotten through a military defeat or on the ground with like allies like Hezbollah and Ansar Allah army in Yemen. As for the Arab countries, we've seen that Saudi Arabia, Jordan, UAE, etc., the Gulf countries, are not serious about taking on Israel, because after the Ansar Allah blockade in the Gulf of Aden, many of these countries are allowing Israel to ship goods through land, through their land. So we can't expect the Gulf monarchies, obviously, to lend a hand. But definitely other regional players like Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Iran even, and all of them have been trying a lot in order to put forth some kind of resistance movement. I definitely think that all the other Islamic countries in North Africa and further to the east should also put more pressure and also try to help out the resistance movements more than they actually are. And right now, for the most part, we are seeing a lot of good words, but very little action for the majority of the Muslim countries, unfortunately.
That's it for this edition of our program. Thanks to political analyst Ali Risk joining us from Beirut, and thanks to podcaster and journalist Esha Krishnaswamy joining us from St. Petersburg. And that's a wrap for this edition of the News Review. The Israeli military has confirmed the killing of one more soldier during an encounter with Palestinian resistance fighters on the ground in the Gaza Strip. The military says another trooper was also injured in southern Gaza. Elsewhere, the Palestinian resistance fighters targeted invading forces with mortar shells in central Gaza. The latest fatality brings to 254 the number of soldiers the regime has confirmed dead since launching the ground invasion of Gaza in November. Independent media outlets and Palestinians say the fatalities among the regime's troops are much higher, and that Tel Aviv is hiding the real number to avoid public anger against the far-right ruling coalition. UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese, who presented a report on the Israeli genocide in Gaza, reveals that she was threatened throughout her mandate.
It's been a difficult time. I've been attacked since the very beginning of my mandate. I don't say that it's been a pleasant journey, but I can tell you it's much more. I mean, most of the pain comes from where I have to observe and monitor and investigate day by day. Yeah, I do receive threats. Nothing that so far I have considered needing extra precautions. Pressure, yes, and it doesn't change either my commitment or the results of my work, I think. I say today that Israel cannot behave as it does, as an apartheid state, and face no consequences. And the second thing is that there is amnesia that the state of Israel, around the birth of the state of Israel, because it was the outcome not just of one tragedy, but it's connected to two tragedies. And one is very well known and absorbed, which is the tragedy, the horror of the Holocaust. The other, what it meant for the native people of Palestine, the creation of the State of Israel, dispossession, forced displacement, and this is history.
Jordanians have hit the streets of the capital Amman for the third consecutive night in support of Palestinians while demanding an end to ties with the Israeli regime. The protesters gathered near the Israeli embassy and condemned the ongoing genocide in Gaza. They chanted slogans, carried placards, and waved Palestinian flags. For months, Jordanians have been calling on their government to cancel all treaties with Israel, shut down the regime's embassy, and stop Jordan from being a transit for goods into Israel. Jordan, which hosts 2.4 million Palestinian refugees, has witnessed a number of rallies since Israel launched its war on Gaza. Meanwhile, Moroccans also staged pro-Palestine rallies and asked their government to end its normalization deal with Tel Aviv. Anti-Israeli sentiment remains high across the region as the regime presses on with its genocidal campaign in Gaza, despite a UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hidden Files.
Do you condemn Hamas? This has been mainstream media's favorite question ever since Hamas's preemptive strike on occupied Palestine on October the 7th. But sadly for them, they're no longer the only media that people get their news from. After some 75 years of the ongoing genocide in Palestine, the journalists on the ground were finally able to get their voice across to people all over the world and to inform them of the bombings that have killed tens of thousands of Palestinians, mostly women and children. And that's when October 7th could no longer justify the ongoing genocide, even in the minds of former supporters of the Israeli regime. Now, many have already realized that mainstream media blamed Hamas to buy more time for the Zionist regime to murder as many Palestinians as they could and to occupy as much land as possible. But the question remains, from a legal perspective, who is responsible for the thousands of lives lost, especially since October the 7th? Hello, I'm Marzieh Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files. This is the discussion that we will have today with lawyer and doctor of jurisprudence and human rights activist Stanley Cohen. Stay tuned, please.
Stanley Cohen is an American lawyer and human rights activist. Following graduation from college, Stanley started working as a VISTA volunteer and helped set up legal service projects in Native American reservations. Cohen then went on to work as a community organizer to tackle the issues of homeless teens and later as an administrator in a federally funded anti-poverty agency. He then went on to law school to defend human rights on a legal level and earned a doctorate of jurisprudence. Since then, he has worked on various lawsuits, from those taking on the NSA spying program to others involving false accusations targeting various minorities and individuals. Defending Patrice Lumumba against accusations of the material support of terrorism, and defending the Hamas political leader against extradition by the Israeli regime. Due to his success in various such legal projects, Stanley Cohen has for long been a target for smearing campaigns and various threats which he has survived to date.
Well, thank you so much, Stanley Cohen, for being with us. I'd like to start off with mainstream media's favorite question. Do you condemn Hamas? And what are the legal definitions of their actions according to law?
I like to respond to that question with, who did you pick on before Hamas from 1936 to 1985? The mainstream media likes to use Hamas as the convenient boogeyman, likes to use any quote-unquote Islamist movement, even one that's overseeing, with all the difficulties, the civil society that was voted into office. But it's always Hamas, Hamas, Hamas. So they look to October 7th, and they completely ignore the history of Israeli genocide, Israeli ethnic cleansing, Israeli war crimes, Israeli crimes against humanity, and they say it's Hamas. Do I condemn Hamas? No. Hamas is a national liberation movement that has been in the forefront of the resistance since 1985. It has a leadership that is highly educated, sophisticated, learned, committed to their people from Gaza. These are not people that one day got on a plane and came from Brooklyn, as the Zionists are, to some foreign country. These are people that grew up in Gaza, many of whom the leadership left over a number of years to pursue education elsewhere, received doctorate degrees, they're academics, they're scholars, they're lawyers, they're scientists, they're producers, they're directors, they're artists, and return home to help to liberate Palestine. So do I condemn Hamas? No.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you, because you've represented many people who couldn't afford to pay you along the way. And I mean, given your expertise and your experience, you could have had a lot more money. Why did you choose a different path?
I recently had a discussion with a journalist who asked me the same question. I said, well, I'm sure Henry Kissinger did not get to take his money with him. I'm sure Bill Gates will not be able to take his money with him. We have to make choices in life. Is it about the pursuit of profit? Is it about the pursuit of power? Is it about political control? Or is it about being part of a world community that's here for a very limited period of time, since that they too were not going to spend their lives pursuing money, but pursuing justice?
Well, why did you, you've decided to represent a lot of Hamas officials and other groups too, although there would be repercussions for you? Why is that the case?
Well, I had, years before I represented Abu Marzouk, who was one of the founders of Hamas and was the original head of the political wing and is now still a major senior leader of the movement, I had been involved in supporting Palestinian self-determination, Palestinian independence, Palestinian liberation as a young lawyer. I organized some political actions. I was involved as an attorney representing people that were protesting against Israel years before even Hamas evolved. I had a very active role in a Muslim in the Islamic community in the United States, not trying to singularize it, because obviously it's a community of diversity with different priorities. In fact, through my work representing many dozens of Albanian Muslims who were charged with various situations in the United States and who eventually, as a result of negotiations, went to Bosnia and joined the KLA with the approval of the United States, in essence fighting before the United States dragged NATO in, before the bombings occurred. That connected me in a different light to the Muslim community in the United States in general and to the Palestinian community in particular. And then one day when I had just finished a very long trial and was getting ready to go on holiday for a few weeks, I got a call from the leaders of one of these organizations who asked me if I could go to the federal prison, that there was a gentleman who had been picked up suddenly on an immigration hold, someone who was a lawful resident in the United States. And I really I was too tired and I couldn't do it. And I recommended other lawyers. And then as an aside, I said, well, who is this person? And then he mentioned a name to me, and the name didn't mean anything to me at the time. And he said, Musa Abu Marzouk. And I said, who was that? And then he said, well, I said, no, I'm tired. I need to get away. I've got family and friends that are expecting me. We've got a cabin on the ocean. And then he said, well, he's the head of Hamas. And I went, oh, okay. So I called my family and I said, look, you're going to have to do what you have to do on your own. I've got to go see this gentleman. And I went to meet Abu Marzouk. And we spent a day or half a day talking. And I'll never forget, he looked at me when I walked in and he said, looked up and down at me, up and down. I had, my hair was all over the place and I had ripped dungarees on and I had a sweatshirt on that said, the first thing we do, quoting Shakespeare, we'll kill all the lawyers. And he looked at me and he said, who are you? And I told him, I used a certain term that I'd, a phrase that I'd been told to use to give him comfort that I wasn't there as a representative of the government. I'd been sent friends. And I used it. And he said, well, who are you? As he stared at me up and down, amazed, and looked at me. And I said, well, I'm a lawyer. And he looked at me up and down. And he said, you're a lawyer? He said, I don't need a lawyer. And I said, you're right. You don't need one lawyer. You need a dozen lawyers. And he laughed. And he said, sit down. And I did. And that was the beginning of probably 1,000 hours worth of one-on-one discussions that he and I had over the next 2 years. While we fought his case, initially it was for a removal order from the United States, and then the Knesset, an unprecedented act, issued an arrest warrant and demanded his extradition to Israel to stand trial for the Intifada. We became very close over the course of 2 years. And Abu Marzouk is not just a founder, a framer, and the original head of the political wing of Hamas. He's a brilliant political scientist. He's a brilliant internationalist. He's a travel gentleman who has, and still does, obviously, tremendous experience in politics and reality and history. He understands.
Wow, it's quite interesting, quite beautiful. I want to look at, if you give me permission, ask you a question about your Twitter account or X, because you have a profile picture of two Hamas leaders there. I'd like to know why you have chosen that picture for your profile picture.
Sheikh Ahmed was a friend. I had the privilege and the pleasure of spending time with him, being hosted by him in Gaza on 5 or 6 occasions before he was assassinated. Abu Shanab was a dear friend. I spent a lot of time with Abu Shanab. In fact, the car in which he was assassinated was by an Israeli rocket. I had been in that car just 4 or 5 days before he had been murdered, going to an interview. To show you the kindness, the support, the love of the Palestinian community in general in my relationship with it, I had left Gaza. I was handling a case in California. I figured it was early in the morning. I was asleep and my phone rang. And it was Abu Shanab's wife who told me she was giving me her condolences. She told me that Abu Shanab had been assassinated several hours before, and she wanted to give her condolences to me, his wife of decades, the mother of his children, because she knew how close we were. We were very close. Whenever I would go to Gaza, I would spend hours and days with Abu Shanab. He'd be my escort. He was a professor of engineering at the Islamic University in Gaza. He was educated, got his PhD in the United States. He was very close friends with Abu Marzouk. We hit it off right away. And I could think of no better way of honoring the memory of these two great warriors, these two wonderful, dynamic, principled fighters for justice and human rights.
Well, there are those who talk about Hamas on October the 7th and the legality as we are in the middle of this Israeli genocide. I mean, I'd like to hear your perspective based on international law regarding both sides of this current situation.
Under international law, an occupying force, an occupying state is permitted to maintain the de minimis or the minimum amount of security apparatus until there's a resolution as to the occupation. And that may mean small military outposts. That may mean the presence of occupying military or security forces. It does not permit the introduction of, as they have here, some 800,000 largely European colonialist Jews into the West Bank. It does not permit the theft of land and the establishment of so-called settlements. It does not permit for the building of walls. It does not permit for the establishment of infrastructure, of economy, of an infrastructure, a system that is comparable basically to a city. It doesn't permit it. And what they do, Israel, again, in going one step further, they decided because it's quote-unquote a military zone, then people that have been in the military zone for tens of, you know, for thousands of years are not entitled to due process of the occupying state. They're not entitled to get access to Israeli courts. And as we've seen for years now, even those Israelis going through the Israeli court system are denied any real modicum of justice, due process, and equal protection with a system of government in which the Knesset can largely overrule what the court system wants to do. So what they've done is they've established this military system. It's staffed by military judges, by military security people out of uniform, are not civilians. Israeli police out of uniform are not civilians. Settlers that are carrying weapons are not civilians. Settler outposts that have heavy-duty weapons is not a civilian outpost. So there's that whole definition. But clearly, children, the elderly, the infirm are civilian under international law and should not be removed. But the problem that we have is not knowing who did what, when, where, why, or how, with just competing narratives. But when we talk about competing narratives, there's no debate over what's going on in Gaza. There's no debate what's been going on in Palestine for 75, 80, 85 years, even before the United Nations crafted Israel. Response to that is, Israel, proved your case. The International Criminal Court ruled in 2021 that it has jurisdiction not just over Palestine because it's a signatory to the Rome Statute.
Well, I can't believe we're still watching this murder take place on a daily basis. What can be done to stop this genocide immediately, in your perspective?
The ICC has enough probable cause and has enough evidence to issue arrest warrants for Netanyahu and a dozen of his top advisors. That immediately limits their ability to travel. That immediately sends a message to people that want to come there to meet with them, conspire with them. That raises the accountability and the concern, because that really sends the message, okay, you are a suspected criminal. There is an arrest warrant for you. We're going to file it with Interpol. There is some standing for the notion that assets can be frozen, which Iran is well versed in, although it's been used not legally against Iran over the years, but as a political weapon. Assets can be frozen. Organizations, private entities that are now providing money, that are now providing weapons, that are now providing technical support to the Israeli government are on notice that you are, if you continue, you may yourselves be involved in criminal wrongdoing. The General Assembly can ask the ICJ for an immediate recommendation. There is universal jurisdiction in many countries in this world. Claims can be brought. They've been started already in South Africa, which is similar to the ICC to the extent that they have the power to issue arrest warrants based upon probable cause. Red notices are set with Interpol. In states themselves, for example, in the United States, there can be an effort, there should be, lobbying and political effort to impose the Arms Export Control Act, which would freeze funding and weapons for Israel. There are domestic jurisdiction issues where if I'm a Palestinian and I have Palestinian-American or Palestinian who happens to be in the United States right now, who has family, businesses, homes, et cetera, that have been destroyed, who have been executed, that have been victimized by war crimes, they can attempt to bring domestic actions and domestic courts under U.S. law. There's an issue of what's called extraterritoriality, which has to do with the ability of U.S. courts to reach out for activity and conduct overseas directed at U.S. But keep in mind, the U.S. has had more than a few examples over the years of Palestinian American citizens, including famed journalists, that have been executed by Israel, and the Department of Justice has done nothing in the United States. So again, there's that double standard. So there is an ability to move the ICC to bring an advisory opinion action in the International Court of Justice. for universal jurisdictions to file arrest warrants for Netanyahu and other leaders of the military, to begin to identify businesses. And we know there have been lawsuits in the United States that have gone after tax-exempt organizations that provide money illegally, that are tax-exempt to so-called settlements in the occupied West Bank, in the Palestinian territories. So there is a combination of actions which can be brought domestically and internationally, which can be saying to Israel, enough. But at this point, there have been 20,000 Palestinians who have lost their lives, almost all of them civilians, 60% of them children. 75% of Gaza is in ruins. 1.5 million people have been displaced. No food, no water, no electricity, no medical attention. Who knows what viruses and illnesses and plagues are going to befall. But again, this is not inadvertent. This is a determined effort, a designed plan that Israel has been waiting to unleash, and it has.
Yeah, it's absolutely unbelievable, mind-boggling what is taking place and how everyone is watching it. I mean, based on this international rules-based community that exists right now, do you think that this same community then will actually play a role in stopping this genocide?
I'm not waiting for the world community to all of a sudden grow principle and justice and independence and to move on behalf of the targeted people. If for that, you know, we will be generations away. But I am optimistic that the combination of movement at the ICC, movement at universal jurisdictions, but most important, millions of young, largely young women and men worldwide in the streets, demonstrating, the BDS movement expanding, Israeli military factories and plants that are providing information being demonstrated against, civil disobedience there. There have been acts of criminal mischief as well. So I think this combination, and keep in mind, I'm not naive. I don't believe that Biden or the West or anyone with this is going to step in until after Israel has been able to accomplish the next step of its never-ending Nakba that it's designed to do. But I think they're reaching, and they're not going to step in out of principle or out of purpose or out of passion or out of love or out of humanity. But it's going to reach a point where politically it's boomeranging back against them, and that's when they're going to step in. But meanwhile, the fact that Netanyahu has been given a green light, I mean, now he's invading the south. They displaced 1.5 million people in the north and the center of Gaza and sent them down basically to the south. And now the tanks are rolling into the south. And there's no defense. And there's hundreds, if not thousands, of Palestinians, civilians, again, being slaughtered every day. There are variables. And I'm not suggesting or proposing that Hezbollah or Syria or anyone else continue their involvement or expand it. But that's an issue. Using the old anecdote, the colloquialism, the 800-pound gorilla in the China shop, there's increasing tension and fighting going on with Hezbollah in the north. Syria is pushing back again. I suspect the West Bank is going to explode. The real issue is, I think there's going to come a point in time. Let us not forget, this is as much about Netanyahu trying to save himself from a judicial process that he's under indictment, I believe, in 2 or 3 cases, and the trials are beginning again. In Netanyahu's mind, as long as he can say, we're at war, we're at war, we're at war, we're at war, he's safe. In the minds of the Kahanists that now run the military, the industrial military complex, the security state, as long as they get to say, see what they did to us, us, they're allowed to expand, they're allowed to justify increasing violence, expansion of so-called settlements. I don't know how it's going to play out at this point. One thing is for sure, that resolution, meanwhile, is thousands of Palestinian lives are being lost to the lust, the political lust, not just of Israel, but the proxy masters of the West that have been involved in this situation. And it's not just the West. I look at UAE, I look at Bahrain, I look at Saudi Arabia, I look at Morocco. I look at other Arab states or Gulf states that have been complicit throughout. I look at the fact that we had to beg Egypt to open Rafah even periodically for goods and services to come in. And meanwhile, says, yes, we'll let Rafah. Rafah should be open so that we can displace a million Palestinians. Egypt, you deal. Push them off into the Sinai. Let's send the Bedouin back to the desert. So we have complicity among certain states in the region. And then we have other states that have long supported Palestine. Iran is one. Doha, Qatar has been there. Algeria has been there. South Africa and Africa and the states have been there. So we've got this tension that's underway right now, and I'd like to be able to predict with some modicum of certainty how it's going to end up, but I really can't at this point.
Well, Stanley, I'd like to hear your final comments about the overall situation.
The situation is very clear on what's going on in Palestine. I think the world community, especially the young women and men of the world community, need to stay in the streets, need to demonstrate, need to engage in all sorts of activities against governments, need to make sure that the political leadership understand there's a price to pay for their blind, obedient support for Israeli genocide. I send my love and solidarity to the Palestinian people. They know they are loved. They know they have support. We will fight with them. We will work with them. We will struggle with them. We will never forget we are family.
Stanley Cohen, it's been a pleasure having you on Hidden Files. I'd like to welcome my colleague, Maryam Azadcher, to Hidden Files. She's going to bring us a little bit more information about other situations taking place since October the 7th. Well, Maryam, welcome to the Hidden Files team. It's a pleasure having you on board.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure being part of this team.
Well, I'd like to look at, because outside of the Palestinian territories, there were other situations taking place that has had a big effect. Tell us about that.
Yes, of course. So now what happened is that in bombing Gaza indiscriminately, the Israeli regime didn't just destroy Palestinian homes, schools, and hospitals. It also destroyed the widely believed myth that the international law was created to defend the rights of oppressed nations, and therefore there's no need for armed resistance. Now, today, this law has no real legitimacy and power in the eyes of millions who have seen Palestinian parents pull out the bodies of their children from under the rubble in the deafening silence of the so-called international community.
It's often said that one man's terrorist is another's freedom fighter. Well, in this case, one colonialist's terrorist is a nation's resistance fighter, and this has held true throughout history, where indigenous peoples, like Palestinians, were invaded using lethal weapons, stripped of their lands, using legal weapons and documents, and portrayed as the perpetrators of using the weapon of media. But there's one thing these powers cannot win without your consent. And that is the control of your mind. So next time they ask you to condemn those fighting against colonial interests, maybe let them know that you have read their history. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us on this Hidden Files. It's time.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers, sisters, listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program Mafatihul Hayat keys of life. We are looking at giving our brothers and sisters in faith moral support. This is one of our duties towards them. And in that big tree of moral support, there's the branch of protecting our brothers and sisters, whether it is physical or whether it is spiritual, moral, ethical. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salamullah says, love your believing brother in faith, in Islam. Be a support for him, for he is a supporter for you. If I act as a support for you, you will naturally act as a support for me. This goes beyond the notion of scratch my back, I scratch your back. That's just purely materialistic. Now we're moving based on a principle that is fundamental, that is Islamic, that is divine by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. إِنْ غَابَ فَحْفَظْهُ فِي غَيْبَتَهُ If this brother is absent, protect him in his absence. Which means that my brother is not with me, we're sitting together. Someone says, oh, by the way, did you see what your friend Ali did? Oh, Ali did this, Ali did that. Well, Ali is not here to protect himself. The protection now falls on me. Now it is my duty to tell the speaker, hold your tongue, for you are attacking my brother. Hold your tongue, for you are doing ghibah. Hold your tongue, for I do not allow you to speak about my brother in his absence. If you have the guts, speak to him face to face. Then the Imam says, it is your duty to protect your brother. وَإِنْ شَهِدَ فَزُرْهُ And if he's available, not absent, if he's around, go visit him. وَأَجِلَّهُ وَأَكْرِمْهُ And give him a bit of, you know, the Imam, when he talk about ijlal, when you see a person and you act that he is almighty and he is, you know, something, this is what we call ijlal. That you get up and you show people that this is an honored VIP person and be generous and kind to him. These are the words of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. And then he said, وَإِنِ ابْتَلَى فَأَعُضُتْهُ وَتَمَحَلَّهُ And when this brother of yours goes through a problem or becomes diseased or whatever the problem might be a cure for him. Be there for him. If he's sick, go take him to the hospital. If he needs wealth, go give him money. If he gets in trouble, solve that problem for him. Whatever he needs, be that cure, be that remedy to his problems. Because at the end of the day, he is your brother in faith, and we do not abandon our brothers. Let us take a short break, and then we will come back.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام همونطوری که این رو گفته بارم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره
امام has mentioned both of these subjects. The very imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree.
محیط زیست نگه سالم نگه داره این دقل ثواب داره
There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون اینم همون امام گفته دیگه
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat. We're talking about protecting our brothers and sisters as a way of giving them moral support. A man came to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, which is Abu Basir, one of the companions of Imam Sadiq. He said, I said to Imam Sadiq, الرجل من أصحابنا يستحي أن يأخذ من الزكاة فأعطيه من الزكاة ولا أسمي له إنها من الزكاة فقال أعطه ولا تسمي له ولا تضل المؤمن. He said, some of my brothers in faith, I go and I give them from my zakah, but I do not tell them this is zakah money. I just give it to them as a gift. Is that okay? Because now he's, Abu Basir is asking a jurisprudential question, because what I'm giving is zakah. Zakah is different than charity, different than sadaqah, different than a hadiyah, because it is, has a hukm shar'i to it. It has an Islamic law attached to it. So when I pay my zakah or my khums, it has to be paid with that intention. Now, Abu Basir finds himself in a very sticky situation, that if he goes to his brother in faith and says to him, this is my zakah, the man might feel belittled, might feel embarrassed that now huquq shar'iyyah, the Islamic taxes apply to him, which means that he is poor. When a person, the Islamic taxes apply to him and he's deserving of it, it means he's poor. He's beyond poor. Because we have miskin and faqir. We have a person who does not have enough for a day, and we have a person who does not have enough for a year. So this person, if I give him my zakah, he's going to get insulted and feel belittled. And I don't want to belittle my brother. If I don't give it to him as zakah, how do I deal with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Do you see how the situation Abu Basir was in? And look at the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Look at the musharrah himself, the judge himself. He said, give it to him. Wala tusammi. Give him the money. And do not tell him whether it is zakah or not. And this is what the Imam, he puts the icing on the cake. He says, وَلَا تُدِلَّ الْمُؤْمِنِ. Do not humiliate a believer. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not accept it, does not like it when a believer is humiliated. To Allah, the Kaaba can get destroyed 70 times fold and burned to the ground 70 times folds, but not one believer gets humiliated. That is the maqam, the status of believers in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And what do? When we come to our brothers and sisters in faith, we go all the way out, as we say. Now, inshallah, neither you or I are among the people who talk about their brothers in faith, but we need to make sure that we help our brothers in faith stay protected, and we protect them and not humiliate them. Among the things that we do in terms of protecting our brothers in faith is also not just them, but also their families, their family members, and specifically their women. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines, dozens of Palestinians are killed in fresh Israeli strikes in the Gaza Strip, pushing the overall death toll of the Russian to more than 32,550. A new footage emerges showing unarmed Palestinian men waving white flags of surrender, fatally shot by Israeli troops in